Let me know.
Well, 6:04 is when we're supposed to be.
Okay.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
Smell! You know that gasoline smell? Smells like victory.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
We're live at PTI Worldwide headquarters. It's time for Stocks and Jocks.
Thank you, Jimmy. S&P futures up 22, NASDAQ futures up 83 after a big move in certain stocks yesterday. Do we have Professor Liu?
I want to congratulate you by starting the show with one of my favorite artists from the 1980s, Peter Gabriel. That song has a fantastic video associated with it, Sledgehammer. And then following it up by one of my favorite quotes from Apocalypse Now. And that fantastic scene, which I don't know how this happened, but my YouTube feed threw that thing up, the helicopter assault threw that video up yesterday. So congratulations on using those two sound bites.
Well, you know why we use the sledgehammer one.
The chief was the one who said to use sledgehammer today.
Why did you use sledgehammer? Because it's Ascension Day?
No. You got to get more in touch with the politics, my friend. When we go back to war with Iran and we it's not because we only have, what is it, 6 months or 6 weeks to not inform Congress. This is going to be a new war. It's not going to be...
That's right.
It's not,
that's the legal interpretation they're putting on it.
You know, that, and the new one's going to be called Sledgehammer. So if you give, if you give it a new name, okay, it's a new war.
So I want to come back. I was looking at my calendar today. I want to come back to the fact that this is Ascension Day.
Yep.
In Christian, you know, a Christian holiday. This is the day in the New Testament. I think it's in the, is it in the Acts of the Apostles? I think the,
I'm not
book.
Sure.
I think it's Acts where Jesus, you know, ascends back into heaven. You know, basically disappears from this world and goes into the,
because he came back after his death and then he was around for a while and then he went up.
Right. And what I thought was interesting, what I wanted to talk about briefly, was a story that I saw earlier talking about the fact that a tremendous percentage of students that are coming out of high school and going into college have absolutely no clue when you start making biblical references to them. Now, Ascension Day may be a little obscure, but I would expect any literate person in the Western Hemisphere to be familiar with something like the Ten Commandments. And there was a story by this college professor, about with interviewing this college professor, who said that she made that reference in her class, and the students just looked at her totally blank-faced, like, what are you talking about? And I just was sort of thinking to myself, that, never mind the belief, the faith element of biblical familiarity and biblical study, the Bible provides us with more reference phrases in this language than any other document, more than Shakespeare, more than any other reference. And, you know, an eye for an eye, or you know, whatever biblical phrase you want to think about. The lack of a biblical reference, actually I think an eye for an eye is Hammurabi, but the lack of a biblical sort of context and reference point is stunning to me, because I remember studying the Bible not so much as a faith document at all, but as literature and sort of a canon of things we expect people to have some familiarity with.
You don't have to be
What's the impact of that if we don't have that?
What do you think one of the major themes of the show is? Is people don't even know what the hell we're talking about.
Well, I think what I was going to say, one of the major themes is we don't know what the hell we're talking about.
I mean, when you talk about, I mean, regardless of whether you're a Bible thumper or nay, the fact that the Ten Commandments are a pretty good list of rules to live by. You know, if you don't believe, you could, even if there was no Bible, you're always the guy who brings up the part about how you need laws when everybody start to live together and not run around hunting stuff. Those are pretty good laws. Don't steal. Don't kill anybody else. I mean, right?
Don't bear false witness. Yeah, don't commit adultery.
Yeah.
I, you know that it is. There are a great set of rules, and I would expect people to understand that much of our legal code comes from that Judeo-Christian legal background that you find in places like the Old Testament.
Well, and you know these guys, but I say know them. You weren't all, guys like Jefferson and people like that have all kinds of quotes that say the Constitution and all that stuff is useless if people lose their morality.
Correct.
Because it's based on that, and if people don't have an idea, I mean, I find the idea of, I don't know if you have the time to read the crap I write to some guys, but I said a thing the other day, and we were talking with Carl, and we were talking with Larissa and Russell, and finally I wrote that little thing yesterday about when there's some, I don't know, my psychologist buddy, Dr. Johnson, has read it, and he's trying to come up with some themes about when people are so far away, and you hit the nail right on the head this morning. If nobody even knows that there's reason for antitrust stuff, we can talk till we're blue in the face. We might as well be in the bar, for God's sake. There's no frame of reference to the people we're talking to. I mean, if you talk about you're not supposed to lie or cheat, and you look at, you know, kind of what Congress is doing, whether or not they can weasel around, not Congress, or not one side or the other, whether or not they can weasel around it with some law, or it's not this, or I made it 90 days, so I'm okay. If there's no morality behind any of this stuff, it's all useless. I mean, when
your point is exactly right, and it goes to I'm not supposed to say that, but it goes to something that, you know, I thought was absolutely astounding about maybe 6 months ago. So Tim Kaine, who is a senator from Virginia, he was I think he was Hillary's VP nominee in 2016.
Really?
But made the comment.
I would have forgot that name. I didn't know who that was.
I think he was her VP nominee. But anyway, I believe he's a senator from Virginia. All right. So he's a guy that's a government. You know, he's a government toady. He's been around through the system. Former governor of Virginia. He made the comment about how our rights, you know, are enshrined in the Constitution, and they come out of the Constitution, and the government is in the position of having to validate or having to provide these rights to its citizens. And I remember hearing that and thinking,
it's all wrong.
You are a moron.
It's all wrong.
That's exactly right. How did you get to this position? Because of course, our founding documents and our founding creed, and this goes to your morality issue, is that rights are come to, you know,
inalienable
rights. We are, you know, all men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with, you know, certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. So rights, if you get into the philosophical discussion, these are so-called natural rights, rights that arise from nature, because we are people. And I mean, fundamentally, it goes back to the idea that we have a soul, that yeah. we are creatures of a creator.
He also was wrong. The Declaration of Independence is our heart and soul, not the Constitution.
Well, I think so.
I do, I mean, too. Two agreements. We can't be doing that.
You can't separate the Constitution from the Declaration of Independence.
But people do.
But they do. I understand that the Declaration is not a legal document in the sense that we don't reach back to the Declaration for legal interpretation. So that's what the Constitution
is for. We
should.
That's what we all fought about to get free.
But it's not a document that sets up the government.
Right.
Okay? It's a document that provides the foundation for what the government is supposed to be and how the government, you know, where the government comes from. And but I was absolutely astounded when I heard him say that. And I thought, dude, you got to go back to, you know, basic American history 101. And to a certain extent, you have to have a biblical reference for that, because that was what the founders were relying on in terms of the way they viewed man. Not a specific type of religion or a specific creed or faith, but in fact, another remarkable thing about the founders was that they were tolerant of all of it, but they understood at some base level that,
they were tolerant of it, unless you were a religion that said it's okay to kill people.
They literally created a document that was tolerant of religions. Religions that were crazy, religions that did not respect the rights of those natural rights of other people. Yeah, that was not a, they didn't tolerate that. But my point is that the religions that were the mainstream religions that were plugging into the country at that point, you know, they were coming from a heritage of religious intolerance. And in fact, a certain number of our people who emigrated to the colonies originally were pretty intolerant.
The Puritans were huge intolerance. And we still had a bunch of that in our blood, I think, unfortunately.
It's natural. Yeah. We're environmentally and genetically engineered that way to be tribal, But the founders understood that that was not the way to go. But they also understood, again, at the fundamental level, again, the Bible gives you this context that people are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and that establishes the value of the individual in this system, and that's what makes us so different, in the world.
Used to. I have a real stupid question. it's only stupid because you shouldn't.
But anyway, go back to is that lack of biblical familiarity? Is this a problem? Should we be teaching this as part of our national dialogue?
I use your quote all the time with our late producer. He's still around with a nice family, Matty Weber, when he was wandering
our
off.
Our former producer.
Yeah. Well, he was wandering off on some tangent one day, and you asked him, Matty, are you a moral relativist? I haven't forgot that term since you said it, but I don't understand. Regarding education, we'll have people. I'll talk to my.
Tom, did you go to Catholic school? Were you a Catholic school product?
Yeah. Well, okay. 12 years, for God's sake.
All right. Yeah. So was my father. Okay.
But it wasn't my education at Catholic school was not much different than my mother's was at a public school. But her point was, you have these kids, and my mother was pretty bright. She would talk about education, and essentially in the 30s, and she said, the idea. And she used to get so pissed off when they'd send like projects home that your mother's supposed to help you with, and she would say, "What's wrong with these people?" And they didn't do it very much then, but now it's all over the place. She goes, "What's wrong with these people? They have a kid who's anxious to learn, who's curious, for 6 hours a day. That's all you need. What are you doing? I mean, you couldn't." She goes, "You couldn't send homework." In my era, Grandma wanted no part of my homework. Most kids had a job when they went home.
That's exactly right.
She goes, but you had to learn your history, you had to learn your math, you had to learn how to read, you had to learn how to comprehend. They made you read stuff in class, they'd pass stuff out, and afterward you took a test on what you just read. She goes, you didn't have to go home and read and come back. So the fact is, you're right there. Do the math right there, correct it right there. When kids go home, they go home because parents have other stuff for them to do. How is it in those days, my mom knew all about history, knew how to add and subtract, knew her, I don't know if they didn't teach necessarily the Bible in the public school, but she knew what difference between right and wrong. They taught everybody. They taught people how to cut your toenails so you were healthy. They told you how to take a bath. They did all that stuff back in the Depression. And now these kids get out of school and you say, gee, they don't seem to know any math. They sure as hell can't read. They can't write. God help if you go. What did Eric used to talk about the first 3 weeks at creative writing at Columbia? He taught people punctuation. Nobody knows how to diagram. What do they do all day? It's my question. What do you do all day? You don't do any of that stuff. I mean, I don't get it.
One of the hallmarks of the COVID debacle was the fact that you had a bunch of parents when the schools freaked out. And the teachers' unions pushed for remote learning, even though they knew it was pointless, it was ridiculous. You had parents sitting there listening to what their kids were being taught over computer screens, and listening to these lessons, and realizing that a significant number of school districts were teaching garbage and pablum and time wasting with their kids. And if you want proof of that, and this will shock you, do you know what state is now ranked in the top, I think it's the top two or three, in terms of reading scores in the United States?
You're going to say someplace like Arkansas or Mississippi or something.
You got it in two, Mississippi.
Really?
Mississippi and one of the other southern states, and I can't remember which one, it may be Louisiana, has actually improved its reading scores significantly. In fact, they're now ahead of New York and California.
Wow.
in terms of their reading scores, because you know why? Because they've gone back to teaching phonics as opposed to this whole language model that was being used. My ex-wife was a speech therapist, but her specialty was reading. She developed a specialty in dealing with how people absorb language and how to teach reading to people. And she taught reading to high schoolers as a sort of a an additional kind of specialized training for SATs and things like that. But she had 10th and 11th grade kids coming to her, and younger, but 10th and 11th grade kids coming to her for a help in reading comprehension, because they couldn't read. Their whole language model had failed them, and Mississippi's gone back to teaching phonics a traditional way. It's how you and I learned. And
God, I hated diagramming sentences. My whole fourth grade is all I remember. But
it works.
Yeah,
you understand. You know how to understand a sentence. You know how to read. I can't describe this for you, but I have a case going here where I've got a pro se plaintiff on the other side. That's somebody representing themselves. And
those are always fun, huh?
Well, it's bad enough that you've got somebody who doesn't understand the law or the rules of procedure, and that's one side of it. But this person cannot. I don't think he can read very well, but I know he can't write. So what gets filed with the court is a continuous, like, two or three page sentence.
Sort of like a, no punctuation. Like a stream of consciousness.
Well, there's no punctuation. There's random capitalization. It takes you, the reader, you have to sit down and read something three or four times to break out where apparently the writer thought this needed to be a sentence. He doesn't give you that hint. Again, no punctuation, no grammar, one block of text, two or three pages that you have to sort through. And I just thought, irrespective of whether this guy's got a legitimate claim, I just thought, how tough is life if this is the way you communicate? And you know, how hard is it to function in a modern society?
How do you deal with the gas company, electric company, people that are trying to screw you up?
I know, it's an eye opener, and I just think, you know, that I just thought, man, to school just failed this guy.
My nephew, lovely bride, she teaches math in one of the near south suburbs. And some of the stories she was telling me, COVID, a little, it's like, you know, she goes, everybody's doing the math at home, right? And she's teaching, you know, high end stuff. She teaches like calculus and things. Well, she teaches geometry the whole bit. And she goes, you know, I come back and the first thing I did is we're going to have a test. And by the way, everybody's got to leave their phone in their locker. She goes, everybody flunked. Everybody's just getting the answers off the internet.
Yep.
And she says, so they decided everybody's supposed to be, you know, keeping pace, right, which was total BS. So they decided they were going to bag geometry. They needed algebra, so they were just going to cut out the geometry year.
Yeah, because people were flunking.
Well, not only that, there's not a whole lot of geometry on the national tests.
Okay.
Even though when you actually think about things spatially, or if you ever become, you know, an engineer or something, geometry is probably your most, you know, the idea of how you know, if you're 15 feet from the building, how far in the building is 50 feet up, how long is the from the 15 foot mark to the mm-hmm. building, you know, stuff about square triangles and those kinds of things. I mean, I think it's a mental thing that you ought to know, because it leads into a lot of other logic, in my opinion.
Exactly.
But she goes, that's the one they decided to forfeit. She goes, these kids, they never caught up. And the weird part, she goes, if somebody, they're abhorrent about keeping somebody back a grade, even if they don't deserve to graduate or go to the next grade. So she said, for math, if everybody flunked, somebody flunked, they made them come back for like 2 weeks for a review. She goes, if you didn't learn anything in the 2 years of COVID, how the hell are you going to catch up in 2 weeks? Yet that was who's in charge of these things?
A lot of what happened during COVID was driven, as I said, by Randy Weingarten and the national teachers.
I think it was already happening though. COVID just made it worse.
Well, but they pushed. I mean, yeah. And they were controlling the policy. There's lots of email evidence out there about the Department of Education, which I'm all four square in favor of abolishing, the Department of Education coordinating with Weingarten especially, but other union heads, and saying, okay, what do you think about this? And, oh, well, we ought to have another, you know, another school, another school holiday or school hiatus for 6 months, even though we know that the virus isn't going after kids, and it's not in most cases going after teachers because they're not in the age group that's affected by it. But regardless, it was a disaster, and the impact is rolling forward. Let me go back to the issue about you know, teaching biblical references and biblical history. It really does, I think, matter that we are losing that common cultural reference point of you know, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and just references, so that because that's part of our cultural milieu, and it's part of our national founding ethic, if you will. And it's troubling when you see this falling through. Sometimes a lot of the stuff would have been taught at church. Okay, church, people don't go to church anymore. All right, fine.
Actually, there's a massive increase in church attendance in the Chicago area with the new Pope.
Well, that's good.
I mean,
But I'm not sure attendance at Roman Catholic services is really the is really going to help promote biblical literacy.
Well, maybe.
You know, most of my friends who are Baptist or Lutheran, you know, laugh at the fact that Catholics don't know the Bible.
For a long time, they didn't want you reading the Bible.
That's exactly right. That's a common holding among our Christian brethren.
They made us read a real lot of it freshman year in high school, only because they said you've probably never read it before, which was true.
I do remember the first time I cracked. So I got a what I call, because I attended a Methodist church for many years, and I called the Bible that I received when I got my first communion, I called that Bible my unabridged Bible, because of course the Protestants don't have the same Bible. They're missing the Apocrypha. The books they call the Apocrypha.
I used to know that stuff.
But they're missing. I think they're missing seven books out of the Old Testament that the Catholics say are part of the canon. In any event, I used to refer to that as the unabridged Bible. But I remember when I got it, and I think the first communion was seventh grade, sixth grade. Yeah. And I remember cracking it open, and I still have it. The it's a fantastic reference, but I remember cracking it open and reading some of the stuff and going, "Oh, I didn't know that was here. I didn't know this was here." The Catholic services read the gospel, and you'll get a New Testament or an Old Testament section in your gospel readings at church.
They used to have an Old Testament one. That's the council. It was all just the new, just the gospels, all you ever got until that's more liberalized. They read some of the Old Testament too.
Yeah, the Vatican II, yeah. Right? Started pushing
and
that.
And they still have people that think the guys like me are all heretics because we're okay with Vatican II. That's a Lefebvre group. What do they call those guys?
Okay, so Vatican
Opus
II.
Dei,
is
Opus
the,
Dei.
Opus Dei. Opus Dei is the real conservative Catholic sect. Vatican II took the Mass out of Latin.
Yep.
And turned the priest around so he was facing the audience. By the way, when I was going through Eastern Europe a couple of years ago, you know, we stopped at a couple of small towns where we were able to walk around and one of them we had a very small town right on the Danube River and it was called Donji Milanovic. In Serbia, and so we went in that the tour group had arranged for a visit to a local church. Now I'm talking a town of maybe 1,000 people. So we go into the church. This is gorgeous Serbian Orthodox church, and the priest conducts the service under those Orthodox ceremonies. The priest conducts the service behind a wall.
Really?
You can't see him. And then he comes out for communion and the blessing at the end. But most of the service is conducted behind a facade. And oh, by the way, you stand for the whole thing.
Wow.
So it was really interesting to see the differences. But to go back to our point, the lack of familiarity with biblical references and with, more importantly, with sort of biblical ethics and biblical culture is I think problematic, because our very founding is based on what I would consider to be a biblical understanding of the nature of man,
right,
and the nature of man as an end unto himself or herself. And I thought it was kind of troubling that I was reading this article and hearing these educators say, yeah, we're getting kids in here that have absolutely no concept of any kind of biblical reference.
There's any, the idea of how to treat people. I mean, when my dad died, my best buddy was my uncle, my mother's sister's husband. He was a fighter pilot, right? A Lithuanian guy, and he, of course, nothing bothered him because he, you know, if he had somebody behind you shooting at you, everything else kind of falls in comparison to that, right?
But the amount of emergencies life-threatening emergencies you saw just on a normal day was enough to sort of make you fatalistic. Yeah,
I remember a bee flying in a car. My aunt was, you know, she was a total romantic, right? Not like my mom. My mom was straight and narrow, but they were totally different personalities, born 10 months apart, and they were best of friends. How they could have been, I don't know, because they were so different. I love my aunt, but a bee'd fly in the car, and she'd like panic, and he'd go, he'd sit there. Everybody relax. Somebody might get stung. You're not going to die. Just chill. we'll get it out of here. But totally calm, and she, of course, wasn't. But he'd just say to me, you know, if somebody like double parked, people used to do that in the hood, right? He'd go, Tom, if everybody did that, would we have chaos or would we have order? And his was very simple. If everybody behaved that way, sort of like on the trading floor, if everybody chased the broker out of the booth with an order, what would the floor look like? A bunch of morons. I mean, you have to have some sort of order, or else you can't live together. I guess if you're all out hunting something, you can do whatever you want because nobody cares, right? But if you're going to live together, you got to have some kind of rules and order, don't you?
You do. By the way, your uncle, the fighter pilot, is of cut from the same cloth that my first aircraft commander was cut from when I was flying, and we were. Yeah, one of the things you do, you have to memorize what's called boldface out of your checklist. So the checklists have, and they're big documents, but they have certain items that are called boldface. And the boldface are the items you memorize. You normally never memorize a checklist because you always want to go through the steps and make sure you're hitting each one. But boldface, you had to memorize. The boldface stuff you had to memorize. And this was a B-52. I was on a B-52. I was flying in as a cadet, and this guy was the aircraft commander. And I had they had given me the checklist a couple of days before, and they said there that the stuff in boldface you memorize. So I had memorized this stuff, and we get on the aircraft, and we're flying along, and he's quizzing me, and he goes, okay, so first, you know, general rule, you have an emergency, aircraft emergency in flight, first move. And I thought, I don't think there's a page in the checklist for general aircraft emergency rules. They're always very specific as to if this light comes on or this happens. So I said, I'm not sure what you're referring to. He said, whenever you have an emergency in the aircraft, your first step is to light a cigarette. And I thought, what? And he said, the point, Cadet Michaels, is that when things immediately, when you have some terrible thing happen, some life-threatening thing that is a legitimate emergency, the first thing you do is relax and don't panic. Take a deep breath. He said, fly the airplane. That's your first job if you're in the air. And think about what the next step is. It's not to run around with your hair on fire. That was the first time I'd ever heard the expression hair on fire. Don't run around with your hair on fire. Freaking out. Sit back, take a deep breath. Okay, what do we do next? And I thought, and that's your uncle. Everybody take a deep breath, relax, don't panic, and think through it. Because what kills you in those situations, in a lot of circumstances, probably the majority of them, is panic. And so there's a whole, you know, generation after generation of aviators have been trained. First thing you do, you know, there's an emergency, take a deep breath, because you have to stay calm and you have to stay in control.
Those guys in training on World War II, I get all this chorus stuff, and I love talking to you about it. I hope the listeners, this is interesting. The amount of people that died in training was dramatic.
Oh, yeah.
And the weird part was, the single biggest reason, according to like five or six people that have written in that I've read, and when people all say the same thing, you sort of, you know, even people on the left and the right all zero in on one, you know, topic they're talking about, at least you can believe the topic, right? or whatever the issue is, because they're both talking about it. They said that the difference in power between the trainer and then when you got in like a, you know, if you got into like a P-47 or P-51 was so dramatic that people couldn't handle the difference. Like they almost needed an intermediate trainer between the two. But how many people got killed the first or second time they got in one, like a real fighter aircraft, because the trainer was like a Piper Cub, and then you're getting this thing and it's like a Rolls Royce. Was that true?
There was a huge jump, especially toward the middle of the war, when we started producing aircraft that had, because our engineering got better, we started producing aircraft that had, you know, tremendous amount of power and asymmetrical thrust. So, for example, something you had to think about that you don't think about with a jet, but you had to think about with a prop aircraft, is the fact that the motor was providing torque. So it was turning this propeller in one direction on a fighter. It was turning the propeller in one direction. Well, there's a counter force that works in the opposite direction to that rotation of the propeller, and it pulls the aircraft in that direction. You have to be aware of that. And if you're not thinking about that all the time, then you could find yourself in real trouble, in an unrecoverable attitude at like low altitude. I mean, generally where it killed people, something like that would kill you, is as you're coming in and you chop the power up to land, or as you're taking off and you've got full power in, and all of a sudden the airplane is handling completely differently because of this torque issue. Now in modern aircraft, oh, by the way, we built hundreds, if not thousands, of aircraft that were really dangerous to fly, and we just accepted the fact, because we didn't have any choice. We were in a war, you know, a war of existence, an existential war. We just accepted the fact that they were going to kill people, in terms of you know, training and in terms of unskilled pilots, rather than coming back, you know, which we would do now and say, okay, we're going to reject this design because it's dangerous. And this, by the way, this trend continued way past World War II. If you look at something like the F-104 Starfighter, which
yeah, I've read
basically,
about that one too. Yeah.
Yeah, which basically is a very high powered jet engine with these things on it. I mean, it was designed to do one thing. It was an interceptor. It was designed to get up, take off, fly in a straight line as fast as you could to get to a spot where it could fire missiles at people. But if you try to use it, you know, it was a reasonably good dogfighter, but it was an incredibly dangerous airplane to fly.
Well, the B-58 was dangerous too, wasn't it?
Yes, the 38 was a very dangerous aircraft. So we tolerated a lot of people getting killed because of the fact that we needed airplanes in the sky. So we threw these designs out and just said, yeah, it's going to require a skillful pilot to fly it. Some of the guys are never going to get there. They're never going to be skillful enough, or they're not going to be skillful enough when we first put them in the cockpit, and it's going to kill them. And we tolerated that. Yeah, the training, I mean, there's a Twitter feed that I follow that, you know, goes this day in aviation, and it reaches back for aviation accidents that occurred on a particular day in history. And the number of accidents from World War II and immediately post-war, where you know, flying planes into mountains, flying planes in bad weather, guys just disappearing, you know, aircraft breaks apart in midair, disappears, are legion.
Well, even so, the first thing with the Wright brothers is, I find this stuff fascinating, but I went to Wright-Patterson Museum. If anybody's ever in Dayton, I mean, you got to spend like 2 days there because you got to read this stuff. But one of the biggest issues with those guys were when you went from glider flights to powered, the big thing was the torque.
Yep.
And what they ended, they fixed that with the rudder, the ailerons, or some kind of.
Well, the rudder is the way you control for it. The Wright brothers were well aware of that, and they had if I'm recalling correctly, the Wright Flyers propellers rotated in opposite directions to offset the torque issue.
The Wright brothers were some of the most brilliant people that ever walked. I mean, to this day, they think that the fact that you got up in the air, there were a lot of guys that were doing that, but they were the first people to invent a wind tunnel to see what the hell was doing before somebody was in it and got killed. And they had wooden propellers that at the museum said, if you laser cut the perfect wooden propeller, it was within a couple thousandths of an inch of what they did. How did they do that, Lou?
Because they were engineers and they were careful.
How would you even know the best shape of a propeller?
Well, they tested it. They did trial and error. They were pretty smart guys. I suggest everybody, if you ever get a chance here in North Carolina, Dayton's fantastic. That museum is a marvel. But if you ever get to North Carolina and get down to the beach, go to Kitty Hawk. The National Monument there for the first powered flight is there, and it's worth sitting there and listening to the docents talk about what they did and how they did it with that airframe. So leading to my next aviation story, since I was talking about people filming you on airplanes last week, so we had a suicide here at Denver. A guy walked, jumped the fence. Yeah, jumped the fence at 11:15 at night. Jumped the fence, and he was a career criminal. He had like 20 arrests. He was been charged with attempted murder. He jumped the fence. The question is, what was he doing out walking around? I don't know, but you can. You guys have a real problem with that in Chicago, just like we do. But he jumped an 8-foot fence, climbed over barbed wire, walked out onto the runway in front of a Frontier Airlines 737 that hit him. And killed him, ingested him into the engine. Yeah. And if you see the reports on the radio reports, they you hear the first responders getting out there, and one of the guys goes, "Listen, we need a cleanup crew here. We've got limbs on the runway," which is what you would expect. I mean, they were probably going 120.
Well, here you get people walking in front of the train.
Yeah, same deal.
I actually saw one night coming back, my brother's, Lou. All of a sudden, I see the train. I see all these emergency equipments. Somebody must have been in a wheelchair, rolled the wheelchair down and rolled the wheelchair in front of the train. And all these guys are picking up, the wheelchair and parts and stuff.
What's left?
It's really, really bad. It's the guy who was the head of the RTA.
Yes, that's right.
But the weird part with him is he walked out, he locked eyes with the engineer and didn't move. The engineer was a head case. I hope he's recovered by now.
Yeah. That was the guy when they found the body or what was left of it. He had tucked in his pocket the procedures for how to deal with a person stepping in front of a train.
Really?
He had printed it out and stuck it in his pocket. Yep. Well, he was about to be indicted, right? He had some criminal thing.
Well, I know a couple of people who did it because they had their third DUI and were going to go to jail.
Yeah.
Anyway, this
is why people hate lawyers. There's a lawsuit now that's been filed against the airport for failing to prevent this guy.
That's so insane. I can't.
From climbing the fence. The short answer is when you pass stupid laws and liability laws like they have here in Colorado, you end up with this kind of lawsuit, suing the
building because the guy jumped out the window. I mean, for God's sake.
Yeah. So anyway, that that terrible case is been filed. I don't know whether it'll survive. Colorado used to have, and I don't know if it's still in place, but they used to have a statute that said if you filed a wrongful death claim that was totally without foundation, or if you filed a particular kind of negligence claim that was totally without foundation, then you ended up paying the attorney's fees for the other side when the case got dismissed.
Who filed
dismissed.
It? The guy didn't file it. He's dead. Who filed it?
Oh, one of the some lawyer on behalf of some of the Frontier passengers who inhaled some smoke because of the.
Oh, really? Fire. So it's not a family member or anything like that.
No. Oh, okay. They're suing the airport. These are people that were injured.
Well, I assumed injured. It was like a long lost cousin or somebody who wanted, you know.
Oh, that could happen. That'll be next. You know, but anyway, Colorado has a statute that requires you to pay the attorney's fees, and you remember that awful attack on the theater here in Aurora, which happened just down the road from where we lived, where that guy came in and shot the theater up during a Batman premiere, killed. I think he killed 12 people. Anyway, a bunch of the families sued the theater. And it was a ridiculous lawsuit. It should never have. I mean, this was a guy who armed himself up, and they, you know, the theater had security. The guy worked out some way to keep a door open. Went out, got back into his car, armed himself, came back into the theater after having wedged open a door, and then started shooting. So these folks sued, and the other side of the lawsuit defending the theater were some of my partners at the firm I was working at, and they issued a warning to the plaintiffs and said, listen, we'll settle for some relatively minor amount based on compared to what they were asking for, but if you lose, we're coming back for attorney's fees.
And I know you guys charge a little.
Well, they went back, so they lost, and the court threw the case out right away. But it was involved. There was a lot of expensive stuff involved up front, trying to figure out what was going on. And so the court throws the case out, and you know the theater said, go back against the families. We want our attorney's fees. And suddenly you've got these I don't know how many plaintiffs' families there were, but the 12 people who were killed were part of it. All you know, in addition to everything else they got to deal with, now they've got a $200,000 or $300,000 hit against them, and that, you know, and now they I don't think they collected. I think they did it. They held it over their heads long enough to send the message, sort of out to people saying, don't try this because you can get hurt.
Sometimes people, we had a few minutes. I'm going to ask you about the economy and the trip to China, and what, you know, what people seem to think is economics these days. It's a lot different than the economics I know. But remember the Los Angeles Dodgers incident where the Giant fans were down there. It was opening day or something.
Oh, where that guy got beaten.
Yeah,
he was killed, right?
I think he died. Yeah,
so, yeah, he did die.
So the idea was they sued the Dodgers. And evidently, the Dodgers had a security firm. I'm making this up, but the principal's there. A securities firm that had, let's say, 25 people the year before. And they never really had any incidents. Everything was fine. And they said, well, you know, we could probably do with like 22. I'm making these numbers up. So they had three people less. So the basis of the suit was if the other three people would have been there, this wouldn't have happened. And I think they got some kind of settlement out of it, but it basically was the decision to stand down or lower your security thing. And I tell you what, I was at a couple of board meetings of CBOE where people would come in and tell you about your security. Lou, it's a rape fest. You need all the security, and by the way, they'll provide it for you. You know, and you're like, so stuff like, you know, you don't have these concrete pillars in front of the front door. Somebody could bash a truck in here.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, what business are you in? Over the concrete pillar. It's like, and yet, if you're on the board and it's somebody else's money, you sit there and go, you don't ever want to vote no for something and have something happen, because then you're tied up to dry.
That's exactly the mentality that they're counting on.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're counting on. But yesterday, Lou, without getting political or where our economy's going, we had a horrible number in the PPI. We've had horrible CPI numbers for 3 months. We've got a population that is gagging. You had stuff like Cisco came out last night and said they're doing incredibly well because of AI. But, oh, by the way, we're laying off 4,000 people.
Yep.
So the stock is up 16. But yesterday, if you looked at the market, and I just want you to comment economically, this capitalist, you know, free market economy that some people talk about, they got their heads so far up their ass. This is not, if you looked at the stocks yesterday of the 14 or 15 people that are on the plane with Trump, every one of those stocks was to the moon. Virtually every, not every other stock, but most of the rest of the market was down. What kind of crony capitalism are we pulling here? Everybody.
Yeah, I've talked on the show before about the fact that, you know, there are a number of things that disturb me about this administration.
But it's not just this one. And it's been going on for a while.
It has been going on for a while, but there are a number of things that, you know, you ask me, you know, don't compare with others, what bothers you about this administration? The kind of influence peddling dealing that is going on with family members and things like that is a legitimate issue, and one that I think needs to be addressed more publicly. Of course, the problem is that you know, as far as the people that are in charge, the groundwork for that's already been laid. But regardless, that's a legitimate issue. The question I've got for you. Okay, so the question I've got for you is this: if you, you've got Musk and you've got whoever else is on that airplane going over,
NVIDIA, you know, Apple, Boeing.
Yeah, operating under Micron, the aegis of
Micron.
Okay, operating under the aegis of the president as he travels, is it worth to the economy? Is it worth having those guys there to talk to their Chinese counterparts in industry and in government, such that we will see some kind of growth here? Is that going to happen?
I mean
that's the theory, right?
In the world, it's always happened. And when Nixon went over there the first time, there were people with him, right?
Yep.
My mother's cousin, my second cousin, he's been dead a while, but he was in one of the first groups that went over there, and he's a mining engineer. And there was a big mining construction company in Columbus that he worked for, and he's a real bright guy, a tough Italian dude, played minor league baseball. He goes over there, and the Chinese said to him, "We'll buy one of every one of your machines." And he looks at him and he goes, "No, you won't. I'm getting back on the plane. I'm too old of a cat to get screwed by that one. What are you guys, so you could copy him?" They wouldn't sell them to him. So, but it's always, and I don't really have kind of an issue, but with that part of it. I mean, if Caterpillar goes over there and is able to sell, you know, 5,000 bulldozers and they're made in Peoria, Lou, I'm all for it. But now it's this is getting category. These are not just, they're not just bulldozer makers. These are people who think they're the, what was the book? The Masters of the Universe.
Bonfires of the Vanities. Yeah, Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe.
Yeah, these guys are like the Masters of the Universe. They're the our generation's Harold Janine. Businesses should run the world. Smarter than politics. I mean, this guy from NVIDIA, I wouldn't trust that guy to play poker with him.
What was the line in the 1950s? What's good for the U.S. is good for General Motors, and what's good for General Motors is good for the U.S.
Yeah, remember, I mean, these people actually believe that.
Well, they do, and I'm pretty sure the guy from General Motors believed it when he said it back in the 1950s.
But when you have an inflationary thing, and we've been kicking it around, I think, Lou, I've always had really good guests. Somehow or another, the addition of Larissa and Dr. Demiak from Purdue on Wednesday has tied all of what the rest of us together, because she's the combination of an economics professor and essentially, well, she's not a housewife because she's a professor, but a mother and somebody that does both jobs. And she's been able to pull together a lot of the stuff that I kind of jabber about and everything that I couldn't do myself. When you talk about the people that are with these things that are going up to Cisco's, first of all, nobody even looks at the amount of shares outstanding. When Cisco was up $16, literally got 4 billion shares outstanding. The thing is worth $65 billion more today than it was yesterday. These are numbers you and I can't even comprehend.
Well, I was looking at a number that said, or a report that said that the capitalization or the capitalization value of NVIDIA, SpaceX, Tesla, a couple of other companies, like three or four other companies, is greater than the entire market cap for Europe, for the EU.
It's higher than the whole Russell. NVIDIA, just remember, that's your poster child. I don't expect you to remember all these, because that's my job. NVIDIA, $230, up another $4.30 today. 25 billion shares outstanding. So every $4, $100 billion in market cap. How many stocks do we have to stack together? But when you talk about the inflation numbers yesterday, and you listen to people on CNBC, and you know it's all kind of coming together, and in a bad way. The people who can raise the prices, this is classic Milton Friedman when I sat in class with the guy. The people that can raise it. Inflation is never good because it's never even. I remember him saying that like it was yesterday. The people who can raise the prices are the people on that plane. The people who are sucking hind behinds are the people like us. And the funny part, if you look at the full numbers and don't look at the PPI and the CPI, and there's a couple of people on CNBC that just drone at me all day long, and I almost want to shoot the TV. Not them, the TV.
That's the way I feel when I watch JAG, yeah. By the way. Well, just so
wait
clear.
A minute, you can't shoot with
Catherine. That's why I won't watch that program.
You can't shoot it when Catherine Bell's on there.
I can shoot it at any time. About every 2 minutes, something incredibly stupid comes out of the mouths of somebody on that program, and I just go,
that
no!
part I get, but she's too high. Anyway, but I won't say her name on CNBC, and she's every day she rattles on about the consumer is strong. And Larissa was talking last week. She goes, if you look at my stuff, you know, and she's a professor, so she's not, you know, we're on a tag team, but she got, I think, three kids. She goes, we don't go to breakfast anymore. It's $75.
Yeah.
I mean, we spend that on something else. And by the way, there's the extra 25 going in the tank every week, even though I don't drive that far. It comes out of something else. So she says, if you look at the gross numbers, I'm spending probably as much as I did last year. And if there's any kind of a little emergency, you know, a medical thing or something, even though I don't want to do it, it might be on my credit card. So yeah, the moron on TV is correct. I'm spending as much money as last year. That doesn't mean I'm strong. It means I'm stuck with higher prices.
Yeah.
But yeah. There's a big difference.
So this is an interesting comment. I'll just throw this out, and then I'm going to go because I can see Andrew and Wayne are in the queue here. I shop at Costco. I go to Costco for stuff. And one of the things I was looking at their meals.
By the way, does your Costco sell caskets like mine?
I don't know if it sells caskets. They sell gun safes, which really? I thought was fantastic. But I was looking at their prepared meals and thinking, this place is going to explode in business because I can come in here and get a full prepared, if I don't want to cook at home, instead of going out, I can get a full compared or a full prepared meal here for four people or whatever for a tenth of the price that I would pay to go out to a restaurant.
Oh yeah.
And if you're cutting back, and I know a lot of people who are, we are, if you're cutting back, this makes all the sense in the world. You don't want to have to prepare a meal from scratch. Okay, fine. Do take a break from that. But instead of going out, we're gonna have, you know, this prepared meal from Costco, which is great. Saves, the only difference is it's not being served to you. You're using your own plates. But the food is pretty good. And it's a tenth of the price.
That's what
of what you're gonna pay going out.
A lot of that happens here. My barber just lost his wife. He says nobody home to cook for me. I stop at Mariano's every night and I grab something. But you know, you can tell you haven't spent much time in New York. Now, I'm not a New Yorker of any, but I,
no,
I noticed...
Right, and I have no desire to.
Okay, but on virtually every block in New York, or every other block, when there's big apartment buildings and stuff, there'll be a store that has just what you're talking about, and the buffet line is probably 30 yards long. There's Chinese food, Greek food, you name it, and everybody just grabs their stuff and walks upstairs. Nobody cooks. You're coming home late.
I remember seeing that at Grand Central.
Yeah.
Grand Central's got that whole food market at one floor. Well, and you know, you guys have that. What's the Northwest station there in, by the river?
Ogilvy, yeah.
Ogilvy has the same thing. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Got to run.
Do you ever go to the
pleasure?
One? Last question. Do you ever go to the one in Frankfurt? It's unbelievable how much you can buy there on the way home.
Oh, yeah.
The train station in Frankfurt, it's unreal.
And any of those major train stations in Europe are incredible for that. Because they're dealing with commuters. All right. See you later.
Talk to you next week. Jimmy, we got our guys. Our guys.
We do.
Guys, how are you? What did you think about the your lessons in aviation from Lou and me?
Well, I found it fascinating. My first goal after I graduated, as I was getting ready to graduate from high school, I wanted to go in the Air Force instead of the Navy. And I had to take the pilot's exam at McGuire Air Force Base, which was a very, very tough exam. The proctor said, if I see anyone moving their hands or their feet, you're out of here. I mean, you pack up your stuff and you're out. So you had to think everything. They would show you different views from a cockpit, and you would have to think in your head without using your hands or feet what controls you were using to cause that change in your cockpit perception. I actually passed that thing. A lot of people didn't pass it. I got a 72. I think 70 was passing, but I also remember when George W. Bush took that same exam, he got a 25.
Wow.
He was president and I wasn't, so there's that.
we had a little weird story. I always have weird stories. We're out skiing in Steamboat, right? So Audrey... getting to become a pretty decent skier, but she still would, you know, it gets to the point where, I mean, I was never that good of a skier, but I would look at the run and I could tell whether I could do it or not. I mean, if it was a bunch of bumps, I'd go, nah. You know, a bunch of trees, I'd go, nah. But if it looked like it was groomed, even if it was pretty steep, I'm okay with it. So we come down this really difficult blue run, right? And, you know, Audrey does fine. So there's a pull-off to the side. I think it was the name of the run was Ted's Ridge. Well, they just groomed it, which they didn't normally do. But it's not even really as steep as the one we came off. So Odd goes, is that a blue run? I said, Odd, come on, we can do this one. So down we start, and if she looks back and sees that it's a black diamond, totally panics, skitters across, lands like off the slope in like the powder on the side. Now I'm down 150 yards, and I'm going, this is not good. Well, these two old guys come by and they save her. They pull her out of the stuff. So we start BSing with these guys. I go, hey, how about if we meet for a beer? I'll buy you guys a beer for saving my girlfriend. And one guy, as soon as he opened his mouth, he had this big ruddy, big red nose. As soon as he opened his mouth, I knew the guy was from Columbus. Right? The accent was just, and this other guy is just very distinguished, maybe 6'2", 6'3". And they're like 70. And they're still skiing every day. They take 2 weeks every year away from the wives and they ski. And the wives don't want to ski, they stay home. So anyway, so we meet these guys in the bar, and the tall guy's telling me, yeah, you know, I was a bomber pilot in World War II. And I go, really? And I said, how'd you become a bomber pilot? He goes, that's easy. I went to fighter school, went through all the tests, like you, and I went to get in the plane. I couldn't fit in it. He goes, well, now you're a bomber pilot. So he goes, I did 20 missions over Germany. He said, the first mission, we didn't make it back across the channel, had a ditch, and they fished us out of the channel. I said, well, that means you didn't have to fly anymore? No, it means I only had 19 more to go. He did another 19 after they fished him out of the channel. But one of the nicest guy. The guy was like, nothing bothered him. you could tell. I mean, they just, boy, talk about, you know, this, the right stuff, those guys.
Yeah, The Greatest Generation. It's it really does, I think, stick that phrase.
Oh, yeah. Andrew, we have you?
Yeah, I'm right here.
I assume. I just assume, because you have your thumb on the pulse of the government, that you knew who was on the plane yesterday, and on Tuesday night you bought all those stocks and made a fortune yesterday.
Well, I got part of that right, because I did review the list. I think there was 19, and then NVIDIA was added at the last minute. You know, I'm a reporter and observer, not a front-running investor. So,
well, that's not front-running. It's public information.
Well, or maybe I should say savvy investor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would never... I guess there's some advantage to going. I would never... If you were to add up the market cap of just the ones I was looking at yesterday, NVIDIA, Micron, Boeing, Apple... We're pushing almost $1 trillion in market cap because they're all on this plane. I mean, I'm not talking about a little bit here. I'm talking about serious, serious money.
Well, let me add something to your previous discussion with Lou. At least a thought, and maybe a controversial thought, but for at least you were comparing, let's say, the General Motors days and... the Nixon era and so forth. Well, one difference between that time and this time is that those CEOs were basically rooted in the United States and in the economies of the United States and their community. And I've been in the workforce long enough to see the difference of when the CEOs of a company were living in a community, and when it's far distant managers who have their henchmen running the operations in a community. And of the people on that list, I don't have it handy, but at least some of them at the Elon Musk level and some others, Wayne, among others, has done a lot of research that these are transplants here to the United States, and the degree of loyalty that they have to the United States are highly questionable, at least to me. And so Musk, for example, the reason his family was from South Africa was... On one side of the family, they were Canadians, and they were supporting the fascists in Europe and in the 1930s, and it became uncomfortable for them then, so they went to apartheid South Africa. And once you start looking at the strands of at least some of these people, and you say, well, maybe they kind of want the United States to be like South Africa used to be in the good old apartheid days of taking away the rights of the dark-skinned people.
Yeah, basically.
And you know, they would say, no, we love it here. Well, yeah, but if they love it here, why are they trying to change this place so much? And to get to the point, when they're over there making deals in China or whatever, they're not necessarily going to care that much about the Chinese taking jobs from Columbus, Ohio, to take your example.
They don't want to be masters of Detroit. They want to be masters of the universe.
Exactly. So,
well, you know, I keep bringing the name up, and I know you guys probably remember it, but I swear, every day I swear I'm going to get this book and actually just read the page for everybody. But there's a page in the book, The Sovereign State of ITT. And if anybody remembers that name, ITT was, they laid, most of the telegraph cables across the ocean and all that stuff. They were International Telephone and Telegraph. And they were the first really multinational. You know, there were other people that did business overseas, you know, like oil companies and stuff, but they, the mindset of the head of the place was a guy named Harold Janine, was so totally different than the guy who ran like Firestone, who was making tires in Akron and wanted to make money. Don't get me wrong, but he was a U.S. guy, where this guy absolutely thought that the company was worldwide. The world was his oyster, not the U.S.
And Chief, I'm so old, I remember the name Dita Beard.
Yeah. But the thing of it was, the governments were just morons you had to toy with to get business done. And really, if business took over the whole thing, the business guys were... It's not that much different than the whiz kids under the McNamara's of the world and those guys that ran the Vietnam War. They thought they were masters of the world, right?
Well, let me connect a couple dots on that.
Please do.
That expand what you say into a more current problem. So ITT's, what was the biggest merger in U.S. history in dollar terms, that put this whole process into the public consciousness, it happened to unfold in Hartford, Connecticut, where at the time I was a newspaper reporter for the major newspaper, the Hartford Courant. And while I didn't cover that case, my later assignments as federal courts reporter made me intimately familiar with what had happened there. Because ITT, to boost its capital, wanted to merge with the oldest insurance company in the United States, Hartford Fire Insurance Company. And so there was a litigation to block the merger that ended up in federal court, and also this state insurance commissioner, Bill Cotter, later elected to Congress. And to try to get to what I think is an interesting point of contrast to today, it ended up in the courtroom of this cantankerous judge who was a brilliant guy, Judge M. Joseph Blumenfeld. And I later covered his court every day. And he was a guy, great legal education, who ate every day at a cafeteria using a yellow meal ticket, where the most expensive lunch was $2.20.
Wow.
And he blocked the merger. I got to know him and his clerks very, very well. In fact, I think he later wrote a recommendation for me to go to law school. But he's sitting up there as a federal judge, and he says, I'm basically, this isn't good for the public, and he blocked it. And that led to this huge lobbying effort, and Wayne referenced it because their lobbyist in Washington on the Republican side was Dita Beard, who later confessed she'd written a memo approving vast donations to the Republican Party for their 72 convention to help grease the wheels. But here's the last part connecting the dots. What these major corporations and their executives have done is say, we don't want judges like this. They're sitting there watching out for the public interest. We're going to get our yes men into these robes, and we'll find them, we'll groom them, we'll put them on the courts, and when we announce our mergers, it's going to sail through. That's a little cynical, but it's from 50 years of observation.
Well, it's not, matter of fact, it's not all that cynical. I've asked various and sundry guests, and I keep asking, when people support candidates for office, at what level do you expect whatever you think you're going to get back? You know, there's people like, you know, where I live, who's ever running for something. I know a guy who did this for Paul Vallis. You have, you know, 15 people over, and it's $100 to throw, and you throw a bunch of beers out there and some crackers and cheese. You're not paying that much for a $100 thing. And you write Paul Vallis or whoever it is, Obama, you know, it could be Trump. You write him a check for $2,000. Now, the first person, what does he get for $100? He gets to shake hands and say he was there. Now, do I, for the $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is, do I get the phone number of a flunky, for lack of a better term? If it's $200,000, do I get the candidate's phone number? I mean, what am I expecting along the line here? And what did I just buy? I mean, and I always bring up the, you know, State Farm's my insurance company forever, so I'm not denigrating them totally. But they have supported a real lot of judges in these areas where judges are elected. Now, what does that mean? If they pony up $100,000 for a judge's spot, I don't think that on a regular day, when you're talking about speeding tickets and whatever else people do, that they give a crap what this guy does. Is it all an investment that someday, somewhere, there's going to be a huge liability case where State Farm is on one side, and this guy is expected to not recuse himself because he got a huge donation, and he's expected to deliver something? I mean, I honestly don't know. I'm asking the question because do you buy? It's like The Godfather. You know, you owe me a favor one day. May never come. Is that what we're doing here?
Yeah, I think so. And let me grab this one because it goes into some in-depth research I did later at the Hartford Courant. So after I got out of law school, I went back to the newspaper, and we were, it wasn't even my idea, but it was to look at in-depth, do insurance companies pay off on complicated claims that of long-term disease arising from the workplace. And you may think, I don't know how the listeners or any of us would feel, it's highly dramatic if you know somebody who's dying or very sick, and possibly the illness came from where they worked. If people are blasé and otherwise, maybe it's not that interesting. But anyway, we spent 9 months working on this story, and a lot of talk to victims or attorneys or prospective victims, legal analysts, insurance companies, employers, to really get a sense of the system. And one of the most interesting developments, going to your point about long-term issues, is that some of the employers were not happy with Yale Medical School because they thought they were too willing to diagnose in favor of victims or workers. So they wanted to fund an alternative clinic at the University of Connecticut Medical School that would be staffed by people that say, nah, that's just bad luck. I'm boiling it down here, but these are complicated judgments, and you can find very well-credentialed medical experts who could have two different views of things. And the employers and their insurance companies lean toward denial. In fact, I remember very clearly a quote from the vice president of United Technologies at one time, in charge of their insurance coverage. His name was Edward Bernanke. And he said, well, we're the largest employer in the state of Connecticut, and here's the problem with our insurance cover, and I could name them here, but maybe I won't. He said their policy is to deny virtually every claim. He says it's probably install it out and then pay peanuts. He says it's probably not a bad policy.
Well, that's what the tobacco companies did forever. Guys always died before they made it to court, right?
Yeah, and he said it certainly helps their profitability, but it hurts people. And here's the bookend to that story, is that new management came into the newspaper, and they looked at our results. We were all ready to go. And they said, nobody cares about this. And they killed this stuff.
Well, Wayne, if you give me 1 second here, I was doing something, well, I don't know about dumb, stupid stuff I do. I wanted to see some of the new ballparks. So I drove down to Pittsburgh, saw a game. Drove up to Detroit. Well, I guess I went to Detroit first, then I went to Pittsburgh, then I went to Toronto. In Detroit, you know, this is back when you could actually go up and buy a ticket from somebody at the gate, you know, who had an extra and walk in. Of course, you can't do that anymore. That's why I don't go anymore. But anyway, so I'm sitting next to this lady and two tall, good-looking kids. Turns out she starts BSing with me, and two kids are her twins. God, they're like 6'5", good looking. They're all like 17, 18 years old. I mean, she's got to be proud of these guys. Behaved as all get out, polite. And she starts telling me that she worked for, I think she was from Jackson. I'm not positive, which is right near Detroit. Something about she worked for a Delphi plant that now has been shut down and moved to upstate New York, allegedly to save $5 an hour because there was so much unemployment in upstate New York, they thought they could get there and get other guys. And she was part of the move out. She had a catalog, what'd she say, a million tools, little tools, whatever. It's a huge deal to move this place. And I said something about, you know, well, I didn't really dig him, but she mentioned her husband. I said, well, you know, what happened to him? And well, he died of this very rare form of brain cancer. And I go, me being, you know, I'm not as, I don't have, my news ears don't perk up like your guys, but I'm not dead either. And I said, really? And she goes, yeah, there's about four or five other people in the plant had the same thing. And I'm going, you don't know it yet, but I'm going to tell you why. I'm not going to say it. Now I know why that plant moved. It had nothing to do with a little less labor in upstate New York. Something was going on in that plant. A lot of people were getting something rare, and it was only a matter of time before they got called in a carpet about it, or am I being totally cynical?
Well, that's what we found again and again, that we operate blissfully or otherwise in the working world thinking somebody's watching over things. But a lot of these OSHA standards were developed in World War II to prevent people from keeling over from fumes, not with any scientific understanding of what the fumes might do to you 8 years later. And to go to your story, often people would only undertake these studies when people would be, you know, comparing notes in the neighborhood or union or, you know, lunchroom and say, hey, didn't Joe have that same kind of illness? And said, yeah, but you know, Willie and John did too. And
well, that was the basis of the Karen Silkwood case, where she blew the whistle on some real unsafe conditions at Kerr McGee. Actually, I knew the there was a movie, of course. I think Sissy Spacek played Karen Silkwood, but
she did too. Yeah,
yeah, she's on her way. She's on her way to meet a reporter for the New York Times, and her vehicle went off the highway and she died. And of course there's all kinds of speculation as to whether the company hired somebody to do that, but the reporter that she was going to see, I used to work with the guy, David Burnham. He was also the guy who exposed, not the same type of story, but he's the guy that wrote about Frank Serpico, the NYPD officer who blew the whistle on the corruption in that department. So, yeah, David was a real shoe leather guy.
Kerr McGee was some kind of a conglomerate. What was going on in that particular plant? I forget. If I remember,
they were somewhat involved in the nuclear energy program. So it had something to do with, obviously, radioactive material, and the workers weren't being protected from that. So, and I think right now with the attacks being made by this increasingly malign corporate, pro-corporate government, you attack the press, you're also limiting those kinds of stories from ever seeing the light of day.
They're totally limited now, I think. Like I say, I keep throwing kudos out to Larissa, but every time she comes on, and she and Russell, we get a clearer figure and a view of this essentially K-shaped recovery. Where's the breaking point, or is there? There was a breaking point in 29. There was a breaking point in 1893. In 29, right now, the parallels, I've talked a bunch of times about in the whole 1920s, in the boom times, allegedly, it was all very concentrated. Actually, the only time other than today where the wealth of the country was in more in the hands of the top 2 and 3 or 4% was in 1929. And we know what happened there. But now we have safeguards against that. I'm not predicting that. But it seems like the agrarian issue then was a problem, because we had 50% of the people still lived in farms. Well, Trump has created, I won't say he's created, but the side effects of what's going on in the Strait and other things are your farmers are absolutely getting obliterated.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see any soybean farmers from Iowa on that Air Force One.
Allegedly, there. That's no. It's way high on the agenda. Is them buying stuff from here? But I just we gotta go to break here. But think of this one. How is it that we have people that absolutely are pro the Venezuelan? And I was never a fan of that guy who ran the place. I mean, the place is pretty corrupt. So he got elected, or he got booted out and didn't leave. We're not talking about a good guy. But the idea is that we have somehow blunted China because they cut the deal with there where they were getting Venezuelan oil, and we don't want that. Well, yeah. Okay, but now we've got a whole plane load of our richest people over there, ready to perform oral sex on these guys to get a deal. I mean, how is, on one hand, we're killing people to keep China out of a place. And by the way, we did kill people on that raid, even though nobody seems to care. A couple of people actually told me, they were Cuban guards. What's the difference? Well, Cubans aren't people?
We're saying we hold the cards, but maybe we don't hold the cards.
Yeah, now we're starving the hell out of Cuba. Who's going to make money in Cuba? What in this administration, what five people are going to go down there and try and steal money from Cuba? Why do we care about Cuba?
The same people that made money before Castro, the corporations and organized crime.
Well, now we're trying to cut these what deals. I get the part where it would probably be a good idea if they bought more Boeing planes. I'm not against that, because those people are working here, and yeah, I'd like to have Boeing sell more planes. Wouldn't you? I would like to see more GE. GE Aerospace is there, right? Trying to sell the engines that are going on the Boeing planes. I don't have any kind of problem with that, but is there any consistency at all? I don't get it. SP Futures up 26, NASDAQ Futures up 77. Except for a big day yesterday. We'll review that real quick. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, Nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single-family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now.
We're back. Low and up, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Jimmy Lawler on the board. S&P futures up 26. NASDAQ futures up 75. We've been up all morning. We've come back a little bit, but still pretty strong. The stocks that we all care about, NVIDIA, the guy we picked up in Alaska on the way to China, that's up another $5. That's a solid... $125 billion in market cap? Just a little chump change, as most people. Cisco is up $16. They've got 4 billion shares outstanding, so that's a solid, what's 16 times 4? That would be like 64, right, by math this early in the morning. Anyway, over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 327. It's 1.4%, so they're picking up on some of ours yesterday and today. FTSE only up 36.3%. These guys have not really gone with the rest of Europe to the same degree virtually any day recently. CAC around up 67.8%. Over in Asia, the Nikkei is actually down 618. That's a full 1%. Not sure about that. Hang Seng's up 60 cents, so they're flat. They're not exactly celebrating. And by the way, Shanghai is down 64. That's a percent and a half. I don't know. Maybe Andrew or Wayne can speculate on why that is this morning. Bonds, this is what you have to look at. Even though we're down... 10 years down 3% today, 3 basis points. I've got the 30-year, even though it's down this morning, it's still it's over 5%, and the TNX, the 10-year, is backed off of 4.5, but just a little bit. The creep seems to be up. Oil down $1.26, just under $100, $99.76, so I guess that's some progress. Brent down $1.37, $104.26. RBOB down 2 cents, but still $3.53. So depending on your state, throw somewhere between 80 cents and $1.10 on top of that, and you've got your gas price up. Well, you got to give the guy a little profit, so make that about $1.40. Gold, which had a rally yesterday, today's up 580. Silver's down $1.80, so not much going on there. Foreign exchange, dollar has got a little stronger. It's under 117 on the euro, 116.99, so just a little bit. And the euro and the British pound's at 135, but the dollar is a little bit stronger. Crypto, down $62, under 80,000, 79,447. As a review yesterday, because it was such a day, S&P was up 43, the NASDAQ up 314, that's 1.2%. Cisco up, Boeing up, we've got NVIDIA up, we have everybody who's Micron up, all the guys on the plane, they did well. Apple, Jimmy, were you on the plane? The plane?
No, I was not on the plane. I couldn't make it to Alaska in time.
Now, would you think he ended up on the... No, I would expect that if Wayne was there, he would be on the main plane and not the follow-up plane. What's the follow-up plane? A prop job or is it another 747? Because they went over with two planes. They couldn't fit all these guys on Air Force One. What's the other one, Air Force Two? Anyway, Jimmy, go on with traffic, weather, sports. We'll get back to our guys.
Okay, and traffic on the inbound Kennedy. Right now it's 29 minutes on from Montrose to the Jane Byrne. Inbound Edens, we're at 47, and that is from Lake Cook to the Jane Byrne. And inbound Eisenhower, we're at 42, and the inbound Dan Ryan is at 27. Cubs lose, Sox win. Cubs are still in first place. At Phoenix, real quick in the weather, we are hot, hot, hot. It is 73 degrees with a high of 101 today. And in Chicago, we are at 52 degrees with a high of 61. Back to you, Chief.
What do you guys think about Chicago mayor going to see the Pope? I don't think that guy's been in a Catholic church in his life.
Well, you know, the Pope has welcomed quite a few people. I'm thinking about maybe trying to get over there myself.
He's probably bored with just talking to old cardinals.
Well, he's a Chicago guy. I think when J.B. Pritzker went to see this Pope, he took him a six-pack of Old Style.
Really?
When he got it, the Pope, he had a real, you know, he had a big smile on his face. He gave him some other stuff, too. But, a lot of stuff was Chicago related.
I think he brought him a frozen pan pizza, too.
Yeah, it was hard to get one of those Chicago hot dogs, I guess, over there.
Well, one of my good friends, Bill Murphy, an attorney who's a little older than me, but God, he's a represented guys. And Andrew and he, if we went to a bar, Wayne, you and I would wander off to the other end of the bar. Those guys would just talk law stuff forever and all these different cases. He went to Mendel, where the Pope went. So he loves the guy. He went to Mendel. To have like a normal guy. But I'll tell you what, the church attendance in Chicago is through the roof since that guy's been Pope.
I think all over the country I've read it's increased. Catholic church attendance anyway.
So anyway, what we were talking before the break, and how do you piece all this together? How do you decide when? I mean, yesterday obviously you want to be long, all this stocks that are somewhat going to appear, but the PPI number yesterday was horrible. Now, the people that can charge more, again, I keep using Milton Friedman references, where he goes, that's why you don't want inflation. It's always uneven. If you just doubled the amount of cash everybody had and everything doubled, everybody's paycheck, everything you bought, it wouldn't do anybody any good. Would it just be like a stock split? But he goes, that's not what happens. Some people are in a position where they can raise prices, some aren't. And, some people are losers and some people are winners. And I look at some of the, I hear about some of the union settlements here lately. One group has in a contract for a year, and over the next 3 years, they're going to get a 14% raise. Andrew Wayne, who the hell was the attorney on that? talk about putting your people behind the eight ball. I mean, they're losing every year, aren't they? Or what am I missing?
And then we heard Trump as he was leaving for China saying the financial situation of the American people is he's not interested in that at all. I mean that's I may be getting some of the words wrong, but that's essentially what he was saying.
Well, that was the gist. the whole idea that this is all. I mean, once you're fixated. I mean, I listened to the other guy I don't like so much, the Secretary of War or Defense.
Oh.
Every time somebody asks him a tough question in Congress, what do you mean? You don't want a nuclear weapon, do you? I mean, this reminds me so much of after 9/11, the Patriot Act, where somebody would say, "Gee, that little thing you put in there looks like it's taken away half my rights." Hey, buddy.
And remember, it was voted on after the anthrax attack, where basically members of Congress were working from home.
Yeah.
And they voted for that they never even read it.
What was the story? Andrew, remember what it was? Hey, man, you want some guy in a turban raping your sister or mom? I mean, don't even read it. You got to vote. It said Patriot on it. You're a patriot. Vote for it. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Well, let me pick up on what Wayne said about this comment, which is, I think, in response to a reporter's question, and when President Trump said that he doesn't think about the affordability. Remember back in the 2012 presidential election, Somebody came up with a little tape recording of the Republican nominee Mitt Romney talking about 47%, and let me think what the quote was, but he was speaking at a dinner and someone secretly tape recorded his remarks in June, and then spent a couple months trying to get some reporter to cover the story. And when it came out in maybe late August or early September, I think it basically was the deciding factor in why Romney lost that presidential election. Because what was the quote? He said, you know, I advocate for the 47% with the implication, not the other people. And yet, think about it, if that waiter or whoever recorded that had not been able to find a reporter, the public wouldn't have known about it. And I think Romney would have been elected in 2012 instead of Obama without that quote. And so here we have a kind of similar quote, but do we have a media apparatus or a concerned voter community that cares about that kind of thing in an a similar way?
What do you think the state of? I've never asked you guys this, and you're here's the actual quote. It's Trump shrugs off Americans' economic concerns over Iran war. He doesn't think about it, not even a little bit, was the comment.
Yeah.
Well, what is the state of, I mean, you inject something once in a while, Andrew, regarding the state of this paper or that paper. What exactly is the state now of the press? I mean, how much of it really is owned by, you know, the masters of the universe? How can a good story still get printed by the Post, the Tribune, somebody? Or are they going to, which is different than, will they invest in somebody doing the story? How effective are people like, you know, Cheryl Atkinson and what was it, John Cass, that left and now have their own stuff? Do they get any kind of real traction? It's not, can't be the same as being in the Tribune. I mean, I
know her and I've followed her work ever since she left CBS, but
she was on the show a couple of times. I thought she was terrific.
Well, she's terrific. She's talented, but here's at this point, I'm not a fan, and here's why. Okay, she had insider whistleblowing type of comments about CBS, and we know that all organizations, including that, have their problems. But then she has gone to work since then for an extreme booster of big corporations and so forth. So she's with Sinclair Networks, which has enormous power.
Okay, who are they?
Well, they're one of the largest, if not the largest, owner of TV stations and they in the United States, and they basically own and run stations that appear to their local audiences as CBS, NBC, ABC, or Fox, but behind it is an extreme right-wing agenda.
Andrew, is that sort of the same thing as the guy from Minnesota? Is that Hubble or Hubbard or Hubbard Brook? Is that, they do the same thing?
I think it's, well, Hubbard, they're an old-time company that, but they're nowhere near as big. So okay. Sinclair, for example,
where did they start? I mean, Sinclair was a gas station when I was a kid.
They're up in outside of Baltimore.
Okay,
and what they did, almost like Fox in their own way, they're complementary parts of the market, is the owners are extreme ultra-right proselytizers who expanded their network and ownership in various ways. And so there's if someone would ever want to see the proof of this, it's in one of these elections, maybe it was 2016, where anchors on about 80 Sinclair stations gave exactly the same editorial, word for word. They were required to do it, and somebody has put this together, people could see it on YouTube, of like 80 talking heads acting as if they're voices of their local community saying exactly the same things.
Andrew, would there be a, I know this is pushing your knowledge, yeah, but whenever I do that, I find out there's something. Is there a Chicago station that these guys run?
Oh, I'm sure.
How could I find out?
Yeah, let me try to look it up right now. But you look
Andy, they also own radio stations. And a lot of them carried the stuff like Rush Limbaugh and, you know, Hannity's radio show. So they make no, make no secret where they're coming from.
Okay, so their Chicago footprint is not as big, but they operate primarily through joint ownership of the Marquee Sports Network carrying Cubs games.
Really?
And distributing digital multicast.
Well, those guys don't do anything but replay Cub games when they're not animated. That thing's useless.
Yeah, but you know, these are complicated strategies, and you're as basically kind of a, they're not quite a startup, but they're relatively new, and it's easier to acquire smaller markets and build from there rather than go into an expensive
market.
So
that's why when you're going across the Midwest, and who was the guy that was on with Rush Limbaugh? He was only kind of worse, the right wing guy. Tell us his name. You know what I'm talking about. But whenever I was driving to Pittsburgh, I was talking about to see the baseball game. Every time I hit the Seek, I hit the AM station in the next town, I get the same guy.
Oh yeah, the vast wasteland of AM radio.
Yeah.
I had XM Sirius in my car, you either got somebody like a Limbaugh or a Limbaugh wannabe, or you get some religious station. I mean, it was like, my God.
Well, I guess, Andrew, you're being very articulate here. I guess and we don't have time today. Maybe we'll kick it up next week. Is it? I mean, we've other people on the show have said, well, you're not going to get any of the CNBC, even though they're supposed to be liberal. Who knows what they are? But the business side surely isn't liberal, or whatever that even means. Or if you're not going to get those guys to go after, say, the drug companies when 5 out of 10 commercials are drug commercials. I mean, is it the money? Is it the ownership's attitude? Is it both? I mean,
it's both, but it's also fear that you'll lose your job or you'll be targeted. Right now, we've got Brendan Carr at the FCC who will. He wants to fire people like Jimmy Kimmel, and at first Sinclair went along with that because they had a merger pending before the FCC. And so you remember last fall, Kimmel was out, and Sinclair Networks, who we were just talking about, they instantly made the decision to butter up the FCC chairman and fire Jimmy Kimmel because Trump wanted it that way. And it was only...
Kimmel's what? They own NBC? Is Kimmel NBC or is he ABC? I don't know.
ABC. So Disney.
Okay.
So Sinclair, it wasn't so much a Disney issue, but Sinclair wanted to have a merger with another... ownership group, and that needed regulatory approval. And so what this administration, through the FCC, has, in a way that is totally unprecedented in American history, they'll be the judge of what comedians can be on TV, or your merger is held up, or voided, or ruled against. And Sinclair instantly went along with it, because they like that, basically.
Well, they get you in the Pentagon too, right?
Well, there's that too, although yeah. That was a step too far even for them, or Fox too, because basically the Secretary of Defense or War or whatever he wants to call himself said, you've got to pre-clear everything you're doing if you want a Pentagon press pass. And the virtually all of the reporters in their organization said, we can't function that way. And they said, then get out, which they had to do. But back to this Jimmy Kimmel thing, the viewers, they organize as unorganized people can best do, and they made it clear, we want to watch the guy. And so Sinclair and the FCC all kind of backed down for the moment. But the fear factor is very heavy in the media. In fact, if you don't mind a few extra moments, just yesterday I was walking along the street, and I called Wayne and I said, Wayne, here's a basic problem. I think the media organizations and the people we know our face is reporting, is your definition of reporting quoting a powerful person on what they think, or is it some combination of that? And what's the powerful people are hiding? And more to connect the dots here, it's no, if you want a job in reporting, it's your job to listen to the public officials and write down what they say. But how, that's not in keeping with what most of us think of the First Amendment or the history of the press.
Well, years ago, I used to say that the White House correspondence, that was the largest collection of stenographers in the country. And that was years ago I said that. So look at it now. I mean, it's,
the thing is,
you know, did you guys, Mr. President, what did you have for breakfast this morning? You know?
Well, the some of the stuff, I think there's always been a judgment on kind of what you print. You know, if every time you went to a White House breakfast and you saw the secretary of God knows what, you know, stealing a half a tuna fish sandwich and stick it in his pocket walking out the door for lunch because you have to buy one. I guess that's news. I don't know if you really have to say that. You know, you sit there and go, what's with this guy? But I want you guys to comment. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, that missive I sent around yesterday, where a lot of the stuff we talk about on the show, and then you talk to other people about it. I mean, we run the risk of whatever side of the aisle you're on or wherever you come from on the show. I'm not saying we're the masters of anything, but we're people that can kind of understand both sides of the argument and generally can get along and discuss it. But I think that some of the things we're talking about, like all the stuff Andrew just talked about, if we went down to the bar tonight where all the 28-year-olds are, they have no idea what... I don't think... it's not like they're dumb, but if I were to ask people about the antitrust stuff I'm concerned about, they're not just... If they just were ignorant about it, I'd be okay with it, but they're not. What do you mean?
Even mildly curious.
No, it's worse than that. They'll say, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
That's what business is supposed to do. If you can take out a competitor and charge more, well, that's just business.
By the way, if I saw a government of a top government official taking a half of a tuna fish sandwich out of a free buffet, there's a good chance I'd be taking the other half. Andy knows that story. I said the one way I survived so long in Washington was to go to a lot of free dinners, lunches, and even a few breakfasts. And, you know, I always had my Ziploc bag handy for, you know.
Well, he's exaggerating a little bit, but here's a true story.
Only a little bit.
The Society of Professional Journalists had some kind of conference, or they were looking for speakers, particularly to advise college students in journalism on the way to be successful. And Wayne was at the press club, and the organizer says, "Well, we'd really like to you to talk to a group of students on how to be successful journalists in Washington." And Wayne said, "Are you sure you want me?" And he says, "Yeah, we need somebody." So what did you tell him, Wayne?
Well, these were actually high school students that were getting ready to go to college, and they wanted to major in journalism. And I said, "So you all want to be journalists?" I said, "Well, first of all, do you have wealthy parents?" You know, I said, "If you don't, you're going to have to go get yourself a good intern." Ship with one of the big media operations, and go to as many free breakfast, lunches, and dinners you can go to, because you know it's free eats. And I said also there's also sometimes free booze.
Look at when I had my first year or two on the board, when we did our Washington meeting, we'd have we'd put up a little buffet in the Capitol building. You know, back when you could just walk in the front door. Well, I mean, that's gone today. But so we had this thing with the shrimp and the bar set up, and we're hanging there. And the staffers would come through, and as soon as they saw the shrimp in the bar, you know, a guy'd grab a plate, and I'd see like five shrimp on the plate. He'd come and he'd shake hands. He'd look at your badge, like CBOE. Who are you guys? Well, you know, we do Chicago Board Options Exchange. Oh, I love you guys. I'm glad you're here. You know, we're working hard on whatever it is you guys do. By the way, what do you do? they grab a drink, swill the drink, get to the end of the line, grab one more drink to go and five more shrimp, and they couldn't have been there 50 seconds. They were absolute masters at it.
Well, before we depart for the day here, I have an important news bulletin that's relevant that your listeners should know about. So Wayne sends me a link a couple of days ago, and when I saw it, I thought it was maybe a joke or something, but here's what it was. It was a report on the podcasting listenership of the Washington Post. You know, this longtime monopoly newspaper here. And what they've done is get into podcasting. So they're like competitors, in a sense, to nationwide through the internet, to your show and many others. And they've had 179 episodes of their podcasts from the Washington Post studio. Chief, think about it. I won't put you on the spot. I'll just ask you to think about it. Sorry to reverse the questions here. But how many free subscribers do you think the Washington Post has for its podcasts?
Well, I have no idea.
And what's the average viewership? Think about it for a second. Here's the answer. 185 subscribers.
Wow.
For free. And the average viewership, which you can see on YouTube, ranges from around 20 people to maybe 100 or
wow.
90 at tops. And I sent that to my brother, and he said, "How can this be?" And I said, "Well, you know, they're competing in a new world where people want interesting information. And you know, by the time it's gone through the kind of corporate mixer, it's just not attracting an audience. When Wayne might come up with a meme or something.
That's Jeff Bezos calling you, by the way.
Yeah, sorry. but just to finish the thought, Wayne sometimes gets, I don't know, 50,000 views on something he just...
Oh, on TikTok, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then I sent you guys a couple. We're out of time here, but I stumbled. I don't usually subscribe to anything on YouTube, but I did for this lady. She's just, I don't know where I got to find out what the hell she does, but she's an economist. And you know, boy, talk about a monotone voice, but the things are 10, 15, 20 minutes long, but she's getting information that I can't get. She, you know, Carl maybe can if you dig somewhere, but I listened to one yesterday about how many U.S. bonds Japan sold last week and how much money they poured in to save the yen because it was going through 160 and they got it back down to 158, and how the people that we hold explanation about how for, you know, 40, 50 years now, because the U.S. has been such a great market, people have been willing to essentially finance our deficits from overseas, and now that we are becoming less and less of an ally in a market, you know, due to however many presidents in a row, they're kind of over it. And China's dropped their, you know, one of the things that I'm sure these guys are talking about is China's dropped their investments here 25% in the last few years. In Japan, the lady was saying that last week, Japan was forced to sell $9 billion worth of treasuries out of like the trillion they have here. Not trillion, but it's way up there. They in Britain have essentially made up the China drop. So when you get somebody in a bar that says, ah, screw Japan, screw UK, they don't do anything for us, what are you talking about? They're funding us, you idiot. You don't really want to insult the people you owe money to a certain extent. Well, she says, if this becomes more than a trickle, who the hell here is going to pick up, you know, the 40% of the overseas investing if all of a sudden, you know, Japan can't, and I don't think most people here, you guys are bright enough to know that Japan has a double whammy here because they've got to take the yen into dollars and then buy oil. So the oil price is going up, but if the yen price versus the dollar is going down, it's like double indemnity, right? And mm-hmm. How we're absolutely screwing them. And how many people here say, screw, we don't care about the Japanese? Yeah, we do. They're funding us, for God's sake. I mean, how do you even get people to understand this stuff? We do it on the show. We try to, but I'm not so sure we're permeating into the most of the world.
Well, you're doing your best, and that's all that can be asked.
But how do you combine the dots of the 2 hours of today's show, where Lou's talking about people aren't learning anything like this in school? If nobody knows what monetary policy is, nobody knows any. Nobody teaches economics anymore. Nobody has a clue that if you pour money into the system, you're going to get inflation. You get to have people talk all day long about inflation and never even mention what causes it. I mean, it seems like both hours come together, don't they? We're talking about, why doesn't anybody realize this? And Lou's talking about, they don't even know it enough to realize it. Is there a connection there?
Absolutely, I think. Even people who got the education that we all received, look how many of them have just almost been hypnotized by this president and become sort of cult members, even with that fundamental education.
Well, they're convinced that whatever the other side would be,
yeah.
And the Democrats aren't doing us any favors.
No, they've got to get their message straightened out too. Because you know the idea now, well, a pox on all their houses. Although, there is one party that's still ostensibly backs constitutional rule in this country, and the other one seems not to.
Well, if you can ignore it, you can ignore it. Hey, guys, good stuff. Talk to you guys next week, if not sooner. I hear it's very hot in Florida.
It's terrible. No, we've had no rain. We're almost like Arizona here. We're in a drought situation. It's serious.
You guys are in the drought up here. We had too much rain for a while, but now we don't have any either, so...
Yeah.
It's crazy. Well, guys, have a nice weekend. Jimmy, nice job. SP Futures up 17. NASDAQ's only up 2, but still up a little bit. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks. Come back, Lawrence. It's only up 50.
That's all, folks.